Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation and for the opportunity to talk about my work. When I sent the title for the talk, I kind of expected a reply that said, well, look, this is the International Conference on Quantum Gravity and we have about 10 people talking on phenomenological quantum gravity. But yesterday I found myself joking that I feel like I'm the phenomenology of the conference. So I thought I'd make a somewhat extended motivation, and I'll also have some apologies because the field is much broader than what I can cover in this talk. So here's the motivation. If one wants to make some progress beyond the standard model, then there are typically two ways that one can go. One can either take the top-down approach and trying to find the fundamental theory, then the problem is that one has to connect it down to the common ground. And what's complicated about this approach is that not only does one needs to find the fundamental theory, but one also needs to come up with the full framework that one needs to connect it to what we know. The other thing that one can do is one can start with what we know, the standard model of particle physics, general relativity, and try to find some straightforward extensions to that. Well, a typical example of both, well, this may be heard in the previous talk, an example for this would be to just take the standard model Lagrangian and add all kinds of terms that you can think of that breaks symmetries that we like. What's complicated about this approach is that it might be kind of hard to find out what of this is actually important if we want to find the fundamental theory. So I like things simple. Actually, the most complicated thing about this talk is to pronounce phenomenology. So I picture myself somewhere in the middle here. People have called that effective models or test theories. Others have called it cute or nonsense. So I like to call it top-down inspired bottom-up approaches. And what I usually do in this case is I take the standard model and I add a specific feature that we think we know the fundamental theory needs to have. For example, extra dimensions or something like a minimal length scale, deformation of special relativity and so on and so forth. And just ask what are the phenomenologies of this specific feature. These approaches do not claim to be a fundamental theory or something like this, but it's an approximation what the full theory would be. And well, I think that in a certain sense, physics is the art of approximation. It's the art of finding out what we can neglect. It's the art of building models, or the art of simplification. So indeed, one could say that science may be described as the art of systematic oversimplification. But this is a conference of quantum gravity, and this middle region might cover more ground. So here are some of these top-down inspired bottom-up approaches that I'd like to mention. So I will talk a bit about the first one, the extra dimensions, and deformations of special relativity, and also generalized uncertainty. What I'm not going to talk about are explicit violations of Lorentz invariance, so I would like to point out that I distinguish between deformation of special relativity that do not point out a preferred frame and violations of Lorentz invariance which do. There are also potential signatures in cosmology, and then there's stuff like decoherence from space-time foams that might show up in various experiments. And, well, maybe next year I'll have some non-locality on that slide as well. So the general question is, if we observe something, is it physics beyond the standard model, or is it actually a signature for quantum gravity? So indeed, one can go so far to say, well, maybe there just is no phenomenology of quantum gravity. So this is a quotation from Freeman Dyson, which is from the review of Brian Greene's book. where he says, well, any differences between the predictions from the classical gravity and quantum field theory might be physically undetectable. So this says basically the whole topic that I'm just talking about doesn't exist. So, of course, I think we have good chances to observe phenomenology of quantum gravity, even if we can't do so yet. And, of course, I also do think that this can lead us the way to find the fundamental theory. So, to me, the question of quantum gravity is how we can reconcile the apparent disagreements between the quantum field theories of the Standard Model and classical general relativity. And I say apparent disagreements because it seems that nature knows how quantum objects fall, so there has to be a solution to that problem. But we actually do not know whether gravity is quantized at all. And also, one should keep in mind that going into the Planckian regime, there might be other modifications that can set in. So there can be a classical modification of general relativity, like higher order terms, things like this. And then there's also the semi-classical region. And this XYZ here under quantum gravity is supposed to indicate that there are various approaches so far that might be candidates for a theory of quantum gravity, say strings, loops, what you like. And now the problem is that if we make some kind of effective model that describes some of these features that we find here, there is some kind of redundancy. So it might not be clear whether it's actually effect of quantum gravity. And then, of course, the next step is that we have to connect these effective models to the phenomenology. And I write here new and old phenomenology, that is to say, it's not sufficient that the theory actually makes new predictions, but it also has to reproduce everything that we have already seen. So, and again, it can, of course, be that various of these models make actually the same prediction. So the problem that we have is, given that we are lucky and actually observe something, then what does it actually tell us about the fundamental theory? So this is a general problem. So here's the problem. Or after 3 years in the States, I learned there's no such thing as a problem. There are challenges. So here's the challenge. The Planck scale, which we get if we combine general relativity with basic principle of quantum mechanics, the Planck mass is the energy at which a particle causes a significant perturbation of the metric that it sits in a volume that is given by its own Compton wavelength. So one can make a very simple estimate for the perturbation of the metric becoming of order 1, and one finds the Planck energy and the Planck length. And, well, the Planck length is very, very small. If you compare it to typical distances that can be resolved at particle colliders today, they would be, well, 10 to the minus 3 Fermi or something. It's a different distance that the LHC could reach. So it seems that the scale is far off than what we can reach with Earth-built colliders in the soon future. This is a funny side remark. And I came across this original paper by Max Planck from 1899, where he introduced the Planck scale. Of course, he didn't call it the Planck scale then, but this is where it first appeared. And it's kind of interesting to note that one of the reasons for him to introduce this scale was that also extraterrestrial and non-human cultures could understand this scale. So, but actually, if one is honest, we don't really know whether this is actually the scale where quantum gravity sets in. So this plot schematically shows the running of the gauge couplings in a Standard Model, the electro weak and the strong interactions, and we know that within the minimal supersymmetric extension of the Standard Model, they meet more or less somewhere around 10 to the 16 GeV, which is already far off. From what I've just told you, you'd expect that gravity comes in somewhat close after this, by 10 to the 19 GeV. But actually, this is an extrapolation over a fairly large range. Just to give you an impression, 16 orders of magnitude is what lies between the diameter of the DNA and the Earth radius. So there can a lot of things head in between that. And indeed, you probably know that during the last decades, there have lots of models been worked out that propose that the true scale of quantum gravity might actually be lower. And I became interested in that because, well, actually, I'm a particle physicist. And of course, you would like to know how particle physics looks like in the Planckian regime, just that it seems to be kind of hopeless if the Planck scale is such large that we think it is. But if the Planck scale was somewhere at a lower range, then this would become important for collider physics. But then you, of course, need a concrete scenario which allows you to lower the Planck scale. In this scenario, are theories with large X dimensions. So this is a very, very short introduction into theories with X dimensions. The most common model that you probably know is the one that was proposed by Akani, Hamid, Dimopoulos and Dwali in 1998. In this case, one has d extra spatial dimensions that are added to our 3 plus 1 dimensional world. They are flat. Each of them is compactified on a circle with radius r. And all particles of the standard model are bound to our submanifold, and it's only the graviton that is allowed to propagate into all of the dimensions. This gives you a relation between the Planck scale that we observe, that is the strength of gravity that we actually measure, the radius or the volume of the extra dimension, and the true scale of quantum gravity in the higher dimensional space-time. This relation is given by the volume of the extra dimension. This kind of solves the hierarchy problem in a certain way because it explains why gravity is so much weaker than the other interaction. Since only gravitons are allowed to propagate into all of the dimension, the force lines can dilute much faster than those of the other interaction. So this explains why on distances much larger than the typical radius of these extra dimension, gravity looks much weaker. So this is what is indicated in this plot. Of course, you might say, well, it's not really a solution to the hierarchy problem because, I've just made gravity special in some other regard. That is, it's only the graviton that is allowed to propagate into all of the dimensions. It's in this point where the motivation for this model comes in, that is given by string theory, which tells us that the gravitons are allowed to propagate into all of the dimensions because they form closed strings and are not bound to the submanifold. It's interesting to note, though, that besides the graviton, there's another particle that does not carry any charges of the standard model, which would be the right-handed neutrino. So this potentially could also propagate into the bulk. But one has to be so fair to say that this does not solve the hierarchy problem in the sense that one has introduced another scale, that is the radius here. And you already see from this equation that this radius is not just the inverse of this new fundamental scale. So the second model that I'd briefly like to talk about is the model proposed by Randall and Sundrum, in which case the extra dimension is not flat, but it is curved. In fact, it's an ADS space, and people like that because they can play around with the ADS-CFT correspondence. And another reason why this model is actually more natural than the ADD model is not only because it's kind of artificial to make the extra dimension flat. I mean, if there's matter on the brain, you'd expect them to be curved, right? So what is nice about this model is that the radius of the extra dimension can typically be about the Planck length. So one does not have to introduce another scale. The reason why this still works with the suppression of the scale is that also in this case the volume of the extra dimensions remains finite. And then for completeness, I should also say that there are models with universal extra dimensions. They are universal in that sense that all particles of the standard models are allowed to propagate into them. A specific feature of this kind of models is that the running of the gauge couplings in the standard model is accelerated. The reason is that the logarithmic running comes from an integration over the four-dimensional momentum space, and if it's a higher dimensional momentum space, then one typically gets a power law, and this makes these couplings run together faster. So here are some observables that one has in this kind of model. The most obvious one is that whenever you have something like a compactified extra dimension, one gets a geometric quantization of the momenta pointing into this extra dimension. That is, one has a tower of excitation. That's also called the Kaluza-Klein tower. And one can have real production of these excitations in the UXD model if there's no specific brain that one has singled out. These can only be produced in pairs. This is just a consequence of momentum conservation. In a scenario with where only the gravitons are allowed to propagate into the extra dimension, the brain is a specific point, so momentum conservation into the extra dimension can be broken. One also has modification due to virtual contribution, so one can have loops of these Kaluza-Klein excitation. The tightest constraints that one currently has come from positional electroweak data, which says that the inverse radius in this scenario should be larger than 4 TeV. I'm not actually sure if this is the most up-to-date constraint, but you find that in the particle data booklet. And it's also important to note that the spacing of this excitation distinguishes the scenario. So typically in the Randall syndrome scenario, since the extra dimension is not flat, the spacing is not equal, but it comes with the square roots of the Bessel function or something like this. So it's not exactly equally spaced. One has to note, though, that these Kaluza-Klein excitations have actually nothing to do with quantum gravity. So why am I telling you that? Because it's basically the same story with gravitons. So, of course, just adding extra dimension doesn't mean we know suddenly how to quantize gravity. So gravity is treated in this scenario on a perturbative level by making perturbation about around the background, and then since it's a higher dimensional space-time, the perturbation of the metric tensor is decomposed into the spin 2 part and a vector field and scalar excitations. And well, one can couple this to the standard model of particle physics. The particles of the standard model are confined to the brain, and one can derive Feynman rules and compute the cross sections. And in this case, one then gets observables for collider physics that are, well, cross sections. So real gravitons can be produced in the TeV range in this scenario. These gravitons would not be detected, so it's essentially a missing energy signature. And again, one also has modification of standard model cross-section due to virtual graviton exchange. So this double wavy line indicates the photon. And well, here you see that typically in the ADD scenario, one can have only one photon because the momentum conservation on the brain is broken. One should also notice that there are very tight bounds from astrophysics. These bounds are specifically tied for the number of extra dimensions being a smaller equal to 4, but since people favor 6 extra dimensions, one can still have the fundamental scale to be at a TeV or something. So signatures that people have looked into are a cooling of supernova that will be enhanced due to the additional production of these Kaluza-Klein gravitons. A similar effect takes place in the early universe, and one can then have contribution to the background from the decay of these bulk excitations. And then there is anonymous reheating of neutron stars by the decay of gravitationally trapped massive gravitons. If I recall that directly, I think it's the last point that sets the tightest constraints. And so this is the perturbative limit that we think we know how to deal with in a certain range. The other extreme that one can look at is when gravity really becomes very strong. And one of the most general predictions that general relativity makes is if you put too much energy into a too small region of space-time, then the whole thing collapses and forms a black hole. Now, in the scenario with large extra dimension, we have seen that gravity on smaller distances becomes much stronger, and that means that the horizon of a black hole increases, because a photon would reach the point where it can no longer escape much earlier. So if you put in some numbers, for example, for a typical mass of a black hole of one TeV, then you'd find that the radius increases from 10 to the minus 38 Fermi to 10 to the minus 4 Fermi. And this is, rather unsurprisingly, it's about an inverse TeV. And it is important to note that for these black holes with a radius of about that size, they are much, much smaller than the typical radius of these extra dimensions, which in the ADD scenario is maximally somewhere around a tenth of a millimeter, could be as small as an inverse MeV or something, but it is still much, much smaller than an inverse TeV. So that means if one looks at the geometry of these black holes, well, it essentially does notice that the space-time is compactified and one can just treat them as being spherically symmetric. And this classical picture gives one a very naive estimate for the production of black holes in collider physics, which is based on the simple picture that one has two partons that collide into each other, and one has to keep in mind that the LHC, unfortunately, is a hadron collider, so these are not actually the constituents, the protons, but the partons. And if they come too close to each other, the impact parameter is smaller than the radius of the black hole, then this will just collapse and form a black hole. The naive estimate for the cross-section is just given by the surface of the black hole. And if one plugs that in and computes the numbers for the total cross-section that one would have at the LHC, then one finds that about one black hole per second would be created. So this is quite a lot, and has people led to call the LHC a black hole factory. And these black holes would give a very clear signature, because we know that black holes are not stable, they decay. And the radius of the black holes is related to the size of the black hole, so these are very, very small, which means they are very hot. The temperature is typically somewhere around 200-300 GeV, which means they decay very fast, about, well, in the range of 1 to 100 Fermi over C. It is important to note that this evaporation is nothing that can be faked by a process you'd expect from, all the cross-section of the particle models. There's been a lot of effort gone into working out the exact signatures that such a black hole would have. By now there are numerical tools for the event generation that one can download on the web. Another thing that is important about these black holes is if one looks at the differential cross-section, so here you see the cross-section as a distribution over the mass of the black hole, so this is the mass, there is a threshold for this effect that cannot actually be computed, that is more or less conjectured. Then, because the LHC is, as I mentioned, a hadron collider, and most of the black holes will be produced very, very close by the threshold. And there's only a very small fraction of them that will have very large masses and subsequently will decay in a lot more particles. So this is a brief summary of the phenomenology of quantum gravity with such a low Planck scale at particle colliders. So we have the black hole production and evaporation. This is, again, schematically shown in this plot. So these two partons would usually make a jet that then hadronizes in lots of particles of the Standard Model. So if quantum gravity comes into play here, then it makes a black hole, which then decays in all particles of the Standard Model. As I mentioned, one can have a real graviton production and modification of cross-section due to virtual particle exchange. So I think this is really exciting because it will give us a first grip on the phenomenology of quantum gravity. It's a possibility to understand more than the perturbative approach, and it sheds a lot of light on the interplay between particle physics and general relativity that one actually could have looked into in much earlier, but people were just not interested in it because, well, if the Planck scale is really at 10 to the 19 GeV, then, well, why would one look into that? But, okay, so here's the reason why I'm not working on that anymore. If one has a theory with the lowered Planck scale, then one runs into a lot of problems. So, for example, if you look at higher order operators that, for example, mediate proton decay, these are usually suppressed with the Planck scale, so you don't have to worry about them. Well, if you have a lowered Planck scale, then they are not so much suppressed anymore. Of course, you can just argue them away by saying, well, there's a symmetry or the operator just doesn't exist or something like this, so you basically forbid this decay by hand. And, well, I don't particularly like that, and it seems to me a lot of other people also didn't like it. So one proposal that has been made here is the split fermion scenario. It works by pulling the wave functions of the particles indicated here, away into the directions of the extra dimension. So if you have different fermions, say different flavors or something like this, they would not all be localized directly around the brain that you have, but they would kind of be pulled away from each other, typically by sometimes the width of their Gaussian wave packages. So if you compute the effective coupling that you would see in four dimensions in this scenario, you'd have to integrate over the product of this wave function. And this coupling can get very, very small because this, well, if you multiply that, there is not so much left because it decays exponentially. So what you can have in this scenario is you can have a very strong suppression of all these higher order couplings without the need to introduce an additional symmetry, just by pulling your particles away from each other. So this is the reason why the first paper on this topic was called Hierarchies Without Symmetries. This is a quick fix for several problems. As I've just said, well, it kind of solves the proton decay and other higher order operators. You can also use it to explain the hierarchies in the masses in the Standard Model, like why is the neutrino so much lighter than the top quark, things like this. You can actually take your higher dimensional space-time and try to find location for your particles that would fulfill all these bounds. This has been done by various people, which is kind of nice. I mean, you have two additional dimensions. You get a map where your quarks are located and so on and so forth. Of course, if you have more dimension, then you have more possibilities to distribute your particles, and there's a lot of ambiguity. So what people have done then is that I've said, well, maybe this, we need to look at a configuration that is very nice and very symmetric, and maybe we have some brain intersections where we can trap the particles in specific places. And I find this kind of ironic because the original motivation of the setup was to get hierarchies without symmetries. So eventually one found it doesn't work by itself, but one has then tried to reintroduce the symmetry to get a nice map of these particles. So to me, this is an indication that this model has reached its limitations. So there are just things that you cannot possibly explain within this model. And one can make things more complicated. So, for example, one can embed the universal extra dimension into the large extra dimension. One can have different radii of the extra dimension or compactification on various topologies. I've talked about the splits. You can have twists and different shapes. And in addition to the black holes, you can have black strings, rings, other things, black Saturns, and so on and so forth. So why am I telling you that? Not because I like to insult people. Actually, most of this thing is, this is really interesting and very impressive work. But to me, it's a bit of too much. To me, it's like you're trying to build a house and you're worrying about the color of the curtains before you've laid the first brick. So as far as I'm concerned, I'd say, well, let's turn on the LHC and let's see if they actually have some signatures about extra dimension, and then we can work out the details of these models. So the point that I want to make here is that these models with extra dimensions were never meant to be more than a qualitative description of the first order effects, and one should not overstretch it. It was kind of funny when I was preparing this talk. I could not recall what I wrote in the abstract. So since my inbox is a mess, I thought the easiest thing to do would be to do a Google search. So I went to Google, typed in my name and abstract loops 2007, and what came out was I found this website where someone commented in a forum about this talk. So he copied the abstract, that is why I found it, and he wrote there that I will sound pessimistic, but this is normal. And that I'm supposed to be unenthusiastic, uncommitted, and cautious. So, since I've just told you what I'm not working on anymore, I will proceed with telling you what I've committed myself to in the last years. But since this is kind of a break in the topic, I would like to take some questions here about this first talk, if there are any. Any questions about the extra dimensions? Yeah?
If there's supposed to be signatures of black holes. Okay, so if there's supposed to be signatures of black holes at the LHC potentially, how would the energy and the cross-energies be able to be expected for the gravity of the surface set? And is anybody searched for the distinct experimentally?
Yeah.
Eventually,
black.
See if there's signatures of that from the moon.
Black holes and cosmic ray events.
Well, yeah.
That what you're asking?
Collisions in accelerators, you've also got actually occurring accelerator experiments going on all the time, cosmic rays flying into interplanetary objects. So.
Yes, people have looked into that. It's in cosmic rays, the situation is somewhat more difficult because you're not actually observing the primary interaction, right? You get this whole particle shower and you have tried to reconstruct what it was initially. But yes, people have looked into this. So there are some constraints on the parameters from ultra-high energetic cosmic range as well.
The estimate you gave about maybe the age that holes per year, that is not assuming any higher dimensions. That was only just planets.
No, this is in the ADD scenario with, yes. I mean, you need the extra dimension to lower the Planck scale. So otherwise, you cannot reach a high enough energy density at the LHC to actually get the stuff to collapse. Okay, so then I'll proceed here. So, okay. So I was coming from the particle physics side, and it's always seemed to me that one of the most general expectations that we have from a theory of quantum gravity is that the Planck length acts as something like a minimal length, as a fundamentally finite resolution of space-time or as a regulator in the ultraviolet, respectively. So I've asked myself, well, in how far can we extend quantum field theory of the standard model by just including this notion of a finite resolution, and what would be the consequences of that? So this minimal length scale shows up in various approaches. My motivation came mostly from string theory. There was an paper somewhere in the early 80s by Gross and Mandel, where they examined the scattering, the string-string scattering in the very high energy range in a, by looking in a, at a space-time description. And they found that one has something like a generalized uncertainty principle. That is, if one interprets the in and outgoing states as particles, then one finds that they do not obey the standard uncertainty, but a generalized version of that. And one also has to keep in mind that if one has a scenario, like I just talked about, in which the Planck scale is actually lowered, then one has also raised the Planck length. And the signatures of such a finite resolution should become important in the same energy range, like the signatures that I just talked about. So this is a very brief motivation, how I looked into the topic. Of course, I was not the first one to think about that. There were various other approaches how to include the notion of a minimal length into quantum field theory, most notably by Achim Kempf, somewhere in the late 80s, I believe. But well, it did not quite work for me, because what I actually wanted to do, I wanted to compute a cross-section, and none of what I found was really helpful for that. So here's how I thought about the topic. The reason why particle colliders work is that if one goes to higher energies, then one goes to smaller wavelengths, and with this one can resolve smaller and smaller distances. So I wanted to have a fundamentally finite resolution of structures, and I basically put that in my hand by saying, well, no matter how high the energy of my particle, the wavelength will never become arbitrarily small, and I can never resolve arbitrarily fine structures. So what I've done is I've modified the relation between the wave vector and the momentum in such a way that it will have an asymptotic limit. So you go to arbitrarily high momenta, but the wavelength does not get arbitrarily small, or the wave vector respectively does not get arbitrarily large. Indeed, it reaches asymptotically a limiting value that is just the inverse of the minimal length. And there are various choices for this function that one can take. Well, people have traditionally often chosen the tangent hyperbolicus, which looks somewhat like that. I personally prefer the error function, but this is an input for the model. However, it has to fulfill certain requirements. The obvious one is that for small energies, it has to reproduce the standard linear relation. The function is ought to preserve parity. It is monotonically increasing. That means it is invertible, and it has exactly one zero, that is, at zero. This is important. I'll come back to that later. And in the large energy range, it reaches the asymptotically constant value. That is basically the feature that I want to have. One should keep in mind that if it has to reach an asymptotically constant value, it cannot be a polynomial of finite order, because that would always diverge. What people often use, though, is a first-order approximation where one just keeps the first term at this. However, one should not take this and integrate it all the way up to infinity, because that will give nonsense. Consequences of the minimal length. You can take this relation between the wave vector and momentum and plug it into the canonical quantization scheme. What you find is that you get a generalized uncertainty principle that is within the first order approximation. You find an additional term such that the uncertainty increases again if you go to higher energies. This is also the behavior that was found in the paper by Gross and Mandel that I mentioned. Another important thing that you find is that the momentum space is squeezed at high energies. That comes basically from the derivative of this relation between wave vector and momentum. So this is the Jacobian. If you put in this example, it's the error function, and you find that it is exponentially squeezed at high energies. These models do also have a modified dispersion relation, and they can but need not necessarily have an energy-dependent speed of light. I should add, though, that the models that I have looked into, they usually do not have an energy-dependent speed of light, but in principle they could have. So this is how I think about it. I think about it as being an effective description of a massive gravitational soup that one has in the interaction region when one has a center of mass energy that is very close by the Planck scale and a small impact parameter. Then one makes a lot of perturbation in the background that we don't really know how to describe. But effectively, they are described through this notion of a minimal length. So the asymptotically in and outgoing particles are free, and the modification only happens in this intermediate region. So that these asymptotic particles are free is an important feature. So there is no modification for the particles unless they interact with each other. One can go on quantize the system. It's very straightforward. The only thing one actually does is whenever there was a momentum somewhere in the Lagrangian, one replaces it with the function P of K, and the K turns into a partial derivative. So all these Lagrangians become higher order Lagrangians. And actually, if you keep in mind that I said it cannot be a polynomial of finite order, these have infinite orders of derivatives. Yeah, one can couple it to the gauge fields in much the standard way. If one looks into the interaction vertices, then to first order, these are just the standard one, and the dominant modification come from the propagators of the theory. So here you have just replaced the momentum with this function P of K. And what you see here in these gray shaded equations is to indicate that one can have an alternative description of the same thing by using an energy-dependent metric. So you can basically translate my approach into the other. In a certain sense, I find this more intuitive to think about. Well, anyway, the receipt to get all this modification is just take the standard stuff and replace the momentum with the relation P of K. Okay, so this is just to mention that if you have this theory with all these higher order derivatives and you compute the equal time commutation relation, you find that it is not a delta function. So this is, of course, what you would expect from the theory, which is no longer strictly local. So just another word about the propagator, because people often get somewhat confused about it. So by construction, the function P of K has exactly one zero. This is important because it means there are no additional poles in this propagator. This goes wrong if one takes only the first order approximation. So one actually needs the asymptotic limit. This model is fairly useful. One can just go on and compute certain observables. We started up by looking into quantum mechanics. However, it turned out, you might have expected this, that there were modifications, but they were far, far too weak to be observable. One can derive modified version of the Feynman rules, and we did then compute some tree-level cross-sections, which worked fairly well. You find bounds on this minimal length scale that are comparable to the bounds from the models with extra dimensions. The specific feature about this cross-circle is that it shows an overall suppression relative to the standard model result that comes from the squeezing of the momentum space at higher energies. And it's also interesting that the loop contribution in this setup become finite. The reason is that if one integrates over momentum space, one gets this additional factor from the Jacobian of the relation between wave vector and momentum, and this basically regularizes all these diagrams. So, of course, if you think about having something like a minimal length scale, then you're immediately running into a problem with Lorentz invariance. The reason is basically if you have a minimal length and you boost it, then you don't want it to become smaller than minimal. That would not work so good. So when I first looked into the topic, I basically tried to ignore the issue. The reason why we could do that was that it was sufficient to assume that such a transformation exists that allows us to keep the minimal length invariant without actually writing it down. However, this is kind of unsatisfactory, so some years later I came back to the topic and try to look into it. And, well, you all know that this is exactly what deformation of special relativity do, where one has something like a minimal length, and this requires a modification of the Lorentz transformation. So it turns out that there is a direct equivalence between what I've just told you, which was my approach starting from the generalized uncertainty, and the least deformation of special relativity. It's fairly easy to see in my approach, the momentum transforms under standard Lorentz transformation. It's just the standard quantity. And if one knows the relation between the wave vector and the momentum and the one transforms like the standard quantity, then of course one can just write down how the other quantity transforms. The other way around, if one knows the new transformation, because one starts from the DSR approach, then one can get the relation between K and P by boosting in and out of the rest frame where one already knows the relation. So this is what is common between the both approaches. This is just an example how such a deformation look like. So here's a deformation of this Lorentz transformation. This is from Li and Joao's paper. However, there are various possibilities to get these deformations of special relativity. And these various choices relate to the various choices that I have for the relation K of P. However, in both approaches, the interpretation of a minimal length is very different. So the DSR approach basically came from special relativity and was a modification of these transformation by just saying, well, in addition to the speed of light being an invariant, we want to have a second invariant for all observers, that is this minimal length scale. So, and if one comes from this side, then these deformed transformation also apply to free particles. And in this case, it is the physical momentum that is actually subject to the deformed transformation. I have to say, though, that I don't completely understand in this case what sets the scale for these effects, because you typically would not expect it to be the energy of the particle, but it would have to have something to do with the energy density that you put into your spacetime. So I was coming from the particle physics side, and the interpretation is a different one. To start with, if you are saying about two observers agree on the minimalness of a length scale, then they cannot actually compare something without making an interaction. So the interaction is very important here. The strength of the gravitational effects is set by the center of mass energy and the impact parameter, so you actually have to get a lot of energy in a small region of space-time. And very importantly, this is the most important difference. In my approach, the free particles do not experience any modified effect. So the DSR only applies to the virtual particles in the interaction region. Yeah, and also I said that before, but the physical momentum transforms always under the standard Lorentz transformation. The reason is basically that it is the asymptotic momentum of the particles, and there is no modification in this area. So here are some of the features of DSR. That is, if you have a modification for the free particles, since the transformation acting on the momentum of the particles is no longer linear, you cannot just add these particles in the usual way, because you would mess up the transformation behavior. One then has to introduce a modified addition law, which yields to modification of the thresholds in particle interactions, though one has to say that a description of the particle interaction is actually missing, because there is no full field theory for DSR. The other important feature is the modification of the dispersion relation that I already mentioned. And one can have here an energy-dependent speed of light that is possibly observable. However, all of the stuff that I just told you works in momentum space, and unfortunately, a position space description is still missing, which is not so good if you want to talk about particles propagating in spacetime. So these are the features of DSR. Now let me briefly mention the bugs of DSR. I think these are very serious bugs because I'm almost done. Because to reproduce the standard model of particle physics, one needs to talk about multiparticle states, and we know that we can have multiparticle states that do not have an upper bound on the total energy, which would be predicted by DSR. So the problem is, in the macroscopic limit, how do you get rid of this maximal energy scale that you have built into your transformation behavior? So here's a proposal how one can do that. If one takes very seriously that what we actually want to look at are, well, we want to have a field theory. So what we should actually look at are not integrated quantities like the total energy of particles, but we should deal with energy densities instead of the total energy, things like this. And we should also keep in mind that we want to describe quantum gravitational effects, and the scale that sets when they become important is not the total energy of a particle again, but it's the energy density that you put into a space-time region. So instead of having a transformation that makes an upper bound on the energy of particle, one should instead require an upper bound on these densities. So, or more specifically, the contraction of the energy momentum tensor with the forward velocity. You would then reproduce the standard DSR stuff if you look at maximally localized particles. This then solves the soccer ball problem, because if you go to macroscopic states, you do increase the total energy of the system, but you typically lower the energy density. So one can reproduce the right limit. So here are some observables from the DSR. The probably best known one is comes from the modification of the interaction threshold, that is for the GCK cutoff. And it has been argued that within the DSR scenario, it would be possible that the cutoff is actually shifted to higher energies. So the issue is that from standard model physics, one would expect there to be a cutoff about 6 times 10 to the 19 eV from the incoming protons, because the universe stops being transparent for them because they scatter on the photons of the microwave background, so they would no longer be able to reach Earth, and the ultra-high energetic cosmic ray spectrum would have a cutoff at this energy when these interactions become possible. So some experiments have claimed to have seen events with excess energy, however the situation is not completely clear there. I've heard that next week actually there is a conference on ultra-high energetic cosmic rays somewhere in Mexico, where I hope this issue will be settled, whether this is an effect or just a glitch in the data. So another observable in this DSR approach would be an energy dependent of the speed of light that would lead to modification in the time of flight for gamma ray bursts. Here the thing is that if photons with higher energy would not move with the same velocity as photons with a smaller energy, then this would lead to a dispersion of the signal that one gets from gamma ray bursts. And it turns out that in some of these models, the typical distortion of the gamma ray bursts would be in about the same time scale than the typical duration of the burst, and that it would become potentially observable. So, what now? The good news is, I hope I've shown you, there are various effective models that incorporate quantum gravitational features, some of which make predictions that will be testable soon. However, the bad news is that the connection between these models and a possibly underlying fundamental theory of quantum gravity is so far more than weak. And the conclusion that I draw from this is that one should develop models that can be applied to various effects and combine their prediction to solve this inverse problem. That is to say, we do not only need a model that says something about the GCK cutoff, or that only says something about cosmology, or that only says something about decoherence effect or something like this, or one would need a model that can actually apply it to all of these effects. So to give you an historical example why I think this is necessary, and let's take general relativity. So what was known somewhere in the beginning of last century was that Mercury has a perihelion precession, but there have been various models that could explain that. It could have been an extra planet, or it could have been a quadrupole moment of the Sun, or a modification of the Newtonian potential. And then there was this weird German guy with this thing called general relativity, who also said something about this perihelion precession. So this alone would not have been sufficient to convince people that it is the right theory. But there was more data that was needed. And in this case, it was the light deflection by the Sun, which was also correctly predicted by general relativity. And since I was 2 weeks ago on a conference on string phenomenology, and Dieter Lust started his opening talk with saying that string theory makes a lot of qualitative predictions, I'd like to point out that here the factor 2 actually mattered. So since the only thing between you and lunch is me, I will not summarize everything that I've just told you, but I would like to tell you why I'm not as pessimistic as Dyson was in this quotation that I showed you. Actually, I find it hard to beat this pessimism of saying, well, it's just not observable anyhow. To this, let me give you another example from the history of science. There are most often various ways that lead to the same answer that turns out to be the right one. The most prominent example might be Schrödinger's wave mechanics and Heisenberg's matrix answer that eventually turned out to be part of the same truth. So the reason why I'm optimistic is that I think it doesn't matter where we start from, whether we start with a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach or somewhere in the middle. I also think it does not matter which direction we start into, as long as we listen to what our theories try to tell us and we listen to what nature tells us. And we do not stop at the problems, but change our direction if we see it doesn't work this way, and also if we don't get distracted by interesting things that we find along the way. So I think if we just listen to nature and to our models, then we will eventually find a way to quantum gravity. Thank you for your attention.
Yes, you said that you should have a very excellent result for us using the piece about the black hole creation of the LHC. And if you do the same calculation for the cross section of the black holes in the most conservative model and without the dimensions, I expect you to get a very small amount, just for the reason of how many, or what's the probability.
In the standard scenario?
Yes.
Well, zero, because as I said, you assume that there's something like a threshold for the effect to take place. The reason is, if you just look at real particles and you just take classical general relativity, if the impact parameter is zero, then you always make a black hole, right? You just really have to hit them head on. So you assume that there's something like an uncertainty that comes into quantum effect that we don't really know how to describe, but that sets a threshold for this effect. And this threshold is the fundamental scale. So if there were no extra dimension and the Planck scale would be at 10 to the 19 GeV, then this is where the threshold would be, and you couldn't reach it at the LHC.
And then one last
one.
So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about some of the astrophysical and stuff that's going on in the GeV fractions. I was curious what your thoughts were about that work and whether you think the more likely for us to be able to do that.
Yeah, I would propose maybe we do that in the break or something, or it would take more time.
Okay, so that's a thanks.